The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 21. At the Tennis. Several days had elapsed. Catherine had been for a walk by herself one morning and came back to find Lennox grinning at her expectantly. "Your young man has been ringing you up, Catherine."
"Who do you call my young man?"
"A new one, Rufus Fenalden's secretary.
You seem to have made rather an impression there. You're becoming a serious breaker of hearts, Catherine. First Derek Kettering, and now this young Knighton. The funny thing is that I remember him quite well. He was in Mother's War Hospital that she ran out here. I was only a kid of about 8 at the time."
"Was he badly wounded?"
"Shot in the leg, if I remember rightly. Rather a nasty business. I think the doctors messed it up a bit. They said he wouldn't limp or anything, but when he left here, he was still completely dot and go one."
Lady Tamplin came out and joined them.
"Have you been telling Catherine about Major Knighton?" she asked. "Such a dear fellow. Just at first I didn't remember him. One had so many, but now it all comes back."
"He was a bit too unimportant to be remembered before," said Lennox. "Now that he's secretary to an American millionaire, it's a very different matter."
"Darling," said Lady Tamplin in her vague, reproachful voice. "What did Major Knighton ring up about?" inquired Catherine.
"He asked if you would like to go to the tennis this afternoon. If so, he would call for you in a car. Mother and I accepted for you with empressement. Whilst you dally with the millionaire's secretary, you might give me a chance with the millionaire, Catherine. He's about 60, I suppose, so that he'll be looking about for a nice, sweet young thing like me."
"I should like to meet Mr. Fenalden," said Lady Tamplin earnestly. "One has heard so much of him. Those fine, rugged figures of the Western world," she broke off.
"So fascinating," she murmured.
"Major Knighton was very particular to say it was Mr. Fenalden's invitation," said Lennox. "He said it so often that I began to smell a rat. You and Knighton would make a very nice pair, Catherine. Bless you, my children."
Catherine laughed and went upstairs to change her clothes. Knighton arrived soon after lunch and endured manfully Lady Tamplin's transports of recognition. When they were driving together towards Cannes, he remarked to Catherine, "Lady Tamplin has changed wonderfully little."
"In manner or appearance?"
"Both. She must be, I suppose, well over 40, but she's a remarkably beautiful woman still."
"She is," agreed Catherine.
"I'm very glad that you could come today," went on Knighton. "Monsieur Poirot is going to be there also. What an extraordinary little man he is. Do you know him well, Miss Gray?"
Catherine shook her head. "I met him on the train on the way here. I was reading a detective novel, and I happened to say something about such things not happening in real life. Of course, I had no idea of who he was."
"He's a very remarkable person," said Knighton slowly, "and has done some very remarkable things. He has a kind of genius for going to the root of the matter, and right up to the end, no one has any idea of what he's really thinking. I remember, I was staying at a house in Yorkshire, and Lady Carnarvon's jewels were stolen. It seemed at first to be a simple robbery, but it completely baffled the local police. I wanted them to call in Hercule Poirot, and said he was the only man who could help them, but they pinned their faith to Scotland Yard."
"And what happened?" said Catherine curiously.
"The jewels were never recovered," said Knighton dryly.
"You really do believe in him?"
"I do indeed. The Comte de la Roche is a pretty wily customer. He has wriggled out of most things. But I think he's met his match in Hercule Poirot."
"The Comte de la Roche," said Catherine thoughtfully.
"So you really think he did it?"
"Of course." Knighton looked at her in astonishment. "Don't you?"
"Oh, yes," said Catherine hastily. "That is, I mean, if it was not just an ordinary train robbery."
"It might be, of course," agreed the other, "but it seems to me that the Comte de la Roche fits into this business particularly well."
"And yet he has an alibi."
Oh, alibis, Knighton laughed. His face broke into his attractive, boyish smile. You confess that you read detective stories, Miss Gray. You must know that anyone who has a perfect alibi is always open to grave suspicion. Do you think that real life is like that? Asked Catherine, smiling. Why not? Fiction is founded on fact, but is rather superior to it, suggested Catherine. Perhaps. Anyway, if I was a criminal, I should not like to have Hercule Poirot on my track. No more should I, said Catherine and laughed. They were met on arrival by Poirot. As the day was warm, he was attired in a white duck suit with a white camellia in his buttonhole. Bonjour, mademoiselle, said Poirot. I look very English, do I not? You look wonderful, said Catherine tactfully. You mock yourself at me, said Poirot genially. But no matter. Papa Poirot, he always laughs the last. Where's Mr. Van Alden? Asked Knighton. He will meet us at our seats. To tell you the truth, my friend, he is not too well pleased with me. Oh, those Americans. The repose, the calm. They know it not. Mr. Van Alden, he would that I fly myself in the pursuit of criminals through all the byways of Nice. I should have thought myself that it would not have been a bad plan, observed Knighton. You're wrong, said Poirot. In these matters, one needs not energy, but finesse. At the tennis, one meets everyone. That is so important. Ah, there's Mr. Kettering. Derek came abruptly up to them. He looked reckless and angry, as though something had arisen to upset him. He and Knighton greeted each other with some frigidity. Poirot alone seemed unconscious of any sense of strain, and chatted pleasantly in a laudable attempt to put everyone at their ease. He paid little compliments. "It is amazing, Monsieur Kettering, how well you speak the French," he observed. "So well that you could be taken for a Frenchman if you chose. That is a very rare accomplishment among Englishmen." "I wish I did," said Catherine. "I'm only too well aware that my French is of a painfully British order." They reached their seats and sat down, and almost immediately Knighton perceived his employer signaling to him from the other end of the court and went off to speak to him. "Me, I approve of that young man," said Poirot, sending a beaming smile after the departing secretary. "And you, mademoiselle?" "I like him very much." "And you, Monsieur Kettering?" Some quick rejoinder was springing to Derek's lips, but he checked it as though something in the little Belgian's twinkling eyes had made him suddenly alert. He spoke carefully, choosing his words. "Knighton is a very good fellow," he said. Just for a moment, Catherine fancied that Poirot looked disappointed. "He's a great admirer of yours, Monsieur Poirot," she said, and she related some of the things that Knighton had said. It amused her to see the little man plume himself like a bird, thrusting out his chest, and assuming an air of mock modesty that would have deceived no one. "That reminds me, mademoiselle," he said suddenly. "I have a little matter of business I have to speak to you about. When you were sitting talking to that poor lady in the train, I think you must have dropped a cigarette case." Catherine looked rather astonished. "I don't think so," she said. Poirot drew from his pocket a cigarette case of soft blue leather with the initial K on it in gold. "No, that's not mine," Catherine said. "Ah, a thousand apologies. It was doubtless Madame's own K, of course, stands for Kettering. We were doubtful because she had another cigarette case in her bag, and it seemed odd that she would have two." He turned to Derek suddenly. "You do not know, I suppose, whether this was your wife's case or not." Derek seemed momentarily taken aback. He stammered a little in his reply. I don't know. I suppose so." "It's not yours by any chance?" "Certainly not. If it were mine, it would hardly have been in my wife's possession." Poirot looked more ingenuous and childlike than ever. "I thought perhaps you might have dropped it when you were in your wife's compartment," he explained guilelessly. "I was never there. I have already told the police that a dozen times." "A thousand pardons," said Poirot, with his most apologetic air. It was Mademoiselle here who mentioned having seen you going in." He stopped with an air of embarrassment. Catherine looked at Derek. His face had gone rather white, but perhaps that was her fancy. His laugh, when it came, was natural enough. "You made a mistake, Miss Gray," he said easily. "From what the police have told me, I gather that my own compartment was only a door or two away from that of my wife's, though I never suspected the fact at the time. You must have seen me going into my own compartment." He got up quickly as he saw Fenalden and Knighton approaching. "I'm going to leave you now," he announced. "I can't stand my father-in-law at any price." Fenalden greeted Catherine very courteously, but was clearly in bad humor. "You seem fond of watching tennis, Monsieur Poirot," he growled. "It is a pleasure to me, yes," replied Poirot placidly. "It's as well you are in France," said Fenalden. "We're made of sterner stuff in the States. Business comes before pleasure there." Poirot did not take offense. Indeed, he smiled gently and confidingly at the irate millionaire. "Do not enrage yourself, I beg of you. Everyone has his own methods. Me, I have always found it a delightful and pleasing idea to combine business and pleasure together." He glanced at the other two. They were in deep conversation, absorbed in each other. Poirot nodded his head in satisfaction and then leant towards the millionaire, lowering his voice as he did so. "It is not only for pleasure that I am here, Monsieur Fenalden. Observe just opposite us that tall old man, the one with the yellow face and the venerable beard."
"Well, what of him?"
"That," Poirot said, "is Monsieur Papopoulos."
"A Greek, eh?"
"As you say, a Greek. He's a dealer in antiques of worldwide reputation. He has a small shop in Paris, and he is suspected by the police of being something more."
"What?"
"A receiver of stolen goods, especially jewels. There's nothing as to the recutting and resetting of gems that he does not know. He deals with the highest in Europe and with the lowest of the riffraff of the underworld." Fenalden was looking at Poirot with suddenly awakened attention.
"Well?" he demanded, a new note in his voice.
"I ask myself," said Poirot.
"I, Hercule Poirot,"
he thumped himself dramatically on the chest,
"ask myself, why is Monsieur Papopoulos suddenly come to Nice?"
Fenalden was impressed. For a moment he had doubted Poirot and suspected the little man of being past his job, a poseur only. Now, in a moment, he switched back to his original opinion. He looked straight at the little detective. "I must apologize to you, Monsieur Poirot." Poirot waved the apology aside with an extravagant gesture. "Bah!" he cried. "All that is of no importance. Now listen, Monsieur Fenalden. I have news for you." The millionaire looked sharply at him, all his interest aroused. Poirot nodded. "It is as I say. You will be interested. As you know, Monsieur Fenalden, the Comte de la Roche has been under surveillance ever since his interview with the juge d'instruction. The day after that, during his absence, the Villa Marina was searched by the police."
"Well," said Fenalden, "did they find anything? I bet they didn't."
Poirot made him a little bow. "Your acumen is not at fault, Monsieur Fenalden. They found nothing of an incriminating nature. It is not to be expected that they would. The Comte de la Roche, as your expressive idiom has it, was not born on the preceding day. He is an astute gentleman with great experience."
"Well, go on," growled Fenalden.
"It may be, of course, that the Comte had nothing of a compromising nature to conceal, but we must not neglect the possibility. If, then, he has something to conceal, where is it? Not in his house. The police searched thoroughly. Not on his person, for he knows that he's liable to arrest at any minute. There remains his car. As I say, he was under surveillance. He was followed on that day to Monte Carlo. From there, he went by road to Mentone, driving himself. His car is a very powerful one. It outdistances pursuers, and for about a quarter of an hour, they completely lost sight of him. And during that time, you think he concealed something by the roadside? Asked Van Alden, keenly interested. By the roadside, no. Ça n'est pas pratique. But listen now. Me? I have made a little suggestion to Monsieur Carrège. He is graciously pleased to approve of it. In each bureau de poste in the neighborhood, it has been seen to that there is someone who knows the Comte de la Roche by sight. Because, you see, monsieur, the best way of hiding a thing is by sending it away by the post. Well, demanded Van Alden. His face was keenly alight with interest and expectation. Well, voilà! With a dramatic flourish, Poirot drew out from his pocket a loosely wrapped brown package from which the string had been removed. During that quarter of an hour's interval, our good gentleman mailed this. The address? Asked the other sharply. Poirot nodded his head. Might have told us something, but unfortunately it does not. The package was addressed to one of these little newspaper shops in Paris, where letters and parcels are kept until called for on payment of a small commission. Yes, but what's inside? Demanded Van Alden impatiently. Poirot unwrapped the brown paper and disclosed a square cardboard box. He looked round him. It is a good moment, he said quietly. All eyes are on the tennis. Look, monsieur. He lifted the lid of the box for a fraction of a second. An exclamation of utter astonishment came from the millionaire. His face turned as white as chalk. My God, he breathed. The rubies! He sat for a minute as though dazed. Poirot restored the box to his pocket and beamed placidly. Then suddenly the millionaire seemed to come out of his trance. He leaned across to Poirot and wrung his hand so heartily that the little man winced with pain. This is great, said Van Alden. Great! You are the goods, Monsieur Poirot. Once and for all, you are the goods. It is nothing, said Poirot modestly. Order, method, being prepared for eventualities beforehand, that is all there is to it. And now, I suppose, the Comte de la Roche has been arrested? Continued Van Alden eagerly. No, said Poirot. A look of utter astonishment came over Fenalden's face. But why? What more do you want? The Comte's alibi is still unshaken. But that's nonsense. Yes, said Poirot. I rather think it is nonsense. But unfortunately, we have to prove it so. In the meantime, he will slip through your fingers. Poirot shook his head very energetically. No, he said. He will not do that. The one thing the Comte cannot afford to sacrifice is his social position. At all costs, he must stop and brazen it out. Van Alden was still dissatisfied. But I don't see. Poirot raised a hand. Grant me a little moment, monsieur. Me? I have a little idea. Many people have mocked themselves at the little ideas of Hercule Poirot, and they have been wrong. Well, said Van Alden, go ahead. What's this little idea? Poirot paused for a moment, and then he said, I will call upon you at your hotel at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Until then, say nothing to anyone.